This morning, we'll be talking about what babies know and how they learn, and getting an appreciation for the fact that relatively recently, scientists who have looked into this subject have discovered that, in fact, from the very beginning, babies know a lot, more than at one time we would have given them credit for. And in addition, they are born with a tremendous capacity to learn, greater, in fact, than their parents and older brothers and sisters. We'll be talking this morning with Allison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology at University of California at Berkeley, and this is her area of interest and research. She is the co-author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, a book titled The Scientist in the Crib, Minds, Brains, and How Children Learn. It was published by Random House in 1999. And it is a book that's really, it's not for psychologists. It's for people who are interested in learning more, understanding more about children. So it might be a good book for parents, for example, or for teachers, or for people who work in daycare or to take care of small children. It's kind of intended to be an overview of what we've learned in recent years about babies. And the title is very deliberate because it suggests the fact that perhaps, like scientists, babies engage in a very deliberate process of observation, accumulation of data, and taking what they learn about the world, comparing it with what they already know, and then continuing to change what it is that they believe that they know as they go along, and in a sense, applying what we call the scientific method to their learning about the world. Our guest will be giving a talk on this topic this evening on the U of I campus at 7:30 in the Levis Faculty Center. It's part of the MillerCom series, and all of these programs are always free and open to the public, so if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're welcome to attend. And if you're listening here this morning and you have questions, you're welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You started out studying philosophy, I understand, and then moved over into doing work on children's language acquisition.
Was that
some of the first thing? What first interested you in doing philosophy, and then how did you make the move from philosophy to psychology?
Well, I think I was interested in philosophy the way most people are, because I wanted to answer big, important, deep, profound questions about the mind and about how we ever come to understand the world around us. There's this deep, deep philosophical puzzle, which is, how is it that we get so little information from the world, just a few photons vibrating at the back of our eyes and waves of air at our ears, and yet we know all of these amazing things about the world around us. So that was the big philosophical question that I wanted to answer. And it always seemed to me that a good way to answer that question would be to actually go out and look at what happens to us from the time that we're babies in the crib with those light waves hitting our eyes and waves of air hitting our ears. How do we get from there to the place where we are now? And I was always a bit puzzled about the fact that philosophers asked this question and then didn't seem to take the obvious step of actually going out and trying to find the answer. So that actually transformed me from being a philosopher full-time to being a philosopher part-time, as I think of myself now, and a developmental psychologist.
Well, it strikes me also that some of the people that were working in linguistics, maybe in other fields as well, who were developing theories about things like how it is that human beings acquire language and how we learn, the same thing was true of them. They were sitting in their armchairs and they were thinking about this, but they never spent time watching babies and watching children grow up and actually thinking about what you can observe actually happening.
Right. Well, the whole field of cognitive science that was starting at about the time I was doing my PhD was a group of people who were trying to answer these questions, these big philosophical questions, in a scientific way, in an experimental way. But even among that group of people, the idea that you could really learn a lot from studying babies and children really only took hold relatively recently in the past 25 or 30 years. And I think there were a couple of reasons for that. One of them, of course, is that children were always sort of women's stuff and, you know, not really something that anyone in philosophy or other sciences would take very seriously. I think another reason was that we only started getting the scientific techniques we need to be able to study babies and young children relatively recently. So it was actually hard to study infants until we started to have video recorders, for example, 25 or 30 years ago. So it's only been relatively recently that we've begun to have a combination of starting to realize these were very interesting people to study and actually having the capacity, the techniques to really study them.
Up until, I guess, relatively recently when this kind of study took place, we asked this question, well, what do babies know when they're born?
Right.
One answer that people came up with was, well, not much. And the metaphor for such a long time was the blank slate.
Right.
That is, they came with nothing, and that then they were immediately bathed in this chaotic wave of stimulus. When you think about it, it actually, you'd think, man, that would really be terrifying if that's the way it was. How could you possibly sort through all of that chaos of information that all of your senses were giving to you if you really were coming to that as an absolute blank? But that was what at one time we thought.
Yeah, that was absolutely. That was the prevailing view, really, for 2,000 years. That was, and until even 30 or 40 years ago, pediatricians and psychologists and other people were telling parents, for example, well, look, there's really not much going on. Babies can't really see. They're little sponges. They're not really making sense of the world around them. And even, you know, the great developmental psychologist Jean Piaget, for example, thought that babies couldn't really understand abstraction or go beyond the superficial appearances of things until they were well into the school age period. And the last 30 years have almost completely revolutionized our ideas. It's turned it 180 degrees so that practically every day we're learning some new amazing thing that even very young babies can do. And we're realizing how incredibly powerful their learning capacities are. So we think that from the very beginning, babies already understand the world, have concepts, are understanding the world abstractly, are making predictions, or have theories and hypotheses that they're going out in the world and testing or even doing experiments from the time that they're very, very, very little. And that's completely different from what we thought even 30 years ago.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. Allison Gopnik is a developmental psychologist. She's on faculty at University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored a book on the subject, so if you're interested in reading more, you can seek it out. It's titled The Scientist in the Crib, and she'll be talking about some of the work that she's been involved in, she and her colleagues, in a MillerCom talk tonight on the U of I campus. And if you have questions, you can call us here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have talked about the fact that babies, when they are born, they know a lot. They're not blank. So what are some of the things that babies know from the get-go?
Well, one of the things that we've discovered they know most about is other people, is us. And if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. We're the most important things in babies' universes. So we've discovered that literally from the time they're born, babies can already tell the difference between, say, a human face and another object. And they prefer looking at human faces. They prefer listening to human voices. One of the most dramatic things that we've discovered is that newborn babies will actually imitate facial expressions. So that if you stick your tongue out at a newborn baby, the baby will stick his tongue out at you. If you purse your lips at a newborn baby, the baby will purse his lips at you. And that may sound just sort of weird when you think about it. But if you think about it a little more, it's actually astounding because there aren't any mirrors in the womb. Babies have never seen their own faces. So to be able to stick out, for a baby to stick his tongue out at you when you stick your tongue out at him, means that he already has to link the way it feels to be him inside, what it feels like to have your tongue in that position, and the face that he sees, that round thing with a pink thing coming in and out, that he's actually seeing when he sees the other person stick out their tongue. So that means that baby is already linking how it feels to be him and what he sees in the faces of others. And that's particularly important because we know that emotions are linked to facial expressions. So we know that when we're happy, we smile, and when we're angry, we frown. So that means that babies already, literally from the beginning, have a way of linking their emotions to the emotions they see on the faces of others. And when I say from the beginning, as you mentioned before, philosophers and other psychologists often will talk about things being innate or there from the beginning. And usually what they mean is they thought about it a lot and they can't figure out how you could learn it, so they think it's innate. When I say it's innate, I mean that my co-author, Andrew Mountsoff, set up a lab in the delivery room in the University of Washington and got into his car in the middle of the night when mothers were going into labor and tested 40-minute-old babies. And 40-minute-old babies will imitate facial expressions. So it really, truly is a capacity that, as you think about it, is very profound and important, sorting through and understanding other people, that seems to be there from the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, it would make sense because it would be one of those things when you think about it. Also, you would realize this is very important for our survival as a species. Babies are totally dependent on the adults to take care of them, and there has to be some way for them right away to establish a bond with you, because if that doesn't happen, then it might make it more likely that the adults would just wander off and leave the baby and say, well, this baby is, I don't like this baby. It's not nice. It doesn't like me. Whatever. Right from the beginning, they've got to think, oh, isn't this the most wonderful creature that I've ever seen, and want to take care of it, because otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
Well, it seems to be a kind of double process, because one thing is that the babies need to get us to feel into contact with them. And one of the things that's interesting is that just this kind of gooing and gawing and making facial expressions in imitation that occurs early on, for you as a caregiver, someone taking care of a baby, that often is a kind of signal, yeah, this is great, I'm in tune with this baby. But of course, the other thing is, we think the very reason that babies are immature and dependent on us for so long is because that gives them a period in which they can figure out what we already know. So imitation also is a mechanism that lets babies learn. Here's what the people around me do. The people around me make this kind of face. They use this tool this particular way. They put a stiff brush on their teeth in the morning and brush it back and forth. All these weird, strange things that we do, the things that make us have a kind of culture. Babies already seem to have ways of learning that, of becoming part of their community in a way, literally from the time that they're born.
We have a couple of callers. Why don't we talk with them? Starting with someone in Urbana on line one.
Yes.
Hello. Yes.
I wonder what the guest thinks of this idea that we've heard so much in the past that babies only develop a sense of self, in later years, and that the crucial point becomes when they differentiate their own selves from their mothers. So I'll hang up and listen to the response to that.
Okay. Thank you for the call.
That's a great question. I think it really depends on what it is that you mean by a sense of self. It certainly is true that babies are linked to other people from very early on. But we think that probably the form that link takes isn't that somehow the baby can't tell the difference between themselves and other people. Instead, it's that the baby recognizes that they are a separate being, but a being who has a lot in common with the other beings around them. And certainly we know that by 18 months, in research that I've done myself, we can show that already babies can take the perspective of another person and understand that a person is different from them. It's actually kind of neat the way we do these experiments. My colleague Betty Repicoli and I did an experiment to try and figure out, when do babies realize that I could want one thing and you could want something else? That's something that traditionally we've thought that babies couldn't and children couldn't figure out till very, very late, till they were in school. And we wanted to find a simple way of asking that question. So what we did was we actually showed the baby two bowls of food, one bowl of raw broccoli and one bowl of goldfish crackers. Babies all love the goldfish crackers, even in Berkeley, don't like the broccoli. And then the experimenter would take a little bit of food from each bowl, and she would either make a disgusted face, so she'd go, "Oh, yuck," or she'd make a happy face. She'd go, "Mmm, yum." Now, what happened was sometimes the experimenter would act as if she really liked the broccoli. She'd go, "Mmm, yum," to the broccoli, and "Oh, yuck," to the crackers. What we discovered was that then what she'd do is give both bowls of food to the baby, put her hand out, and say, "Can you give me some?" So here's the question. What will the baby do? Will the baby give her what he likes, which is what all the traditional wisdom would say, because the baby's not making this differentiation? Or does the baby realize, no, wait a minute, I like this, but maybe she doesn't? And 18-month-olds would give her the crackers if she liked the crackers and the broccoli if she liked the broccoli. So these tiny little ones just kind of toddling around already seem to realize that what they liked might be really different from what someone else liked. And in that sense, they already seem to have a sense of themselves being really differentiated from other people.
Mm. And yet I think that in some way, though, even the little ones, they do, they differentiate, and yet it's my understanding about this that they sort of have this idea, hey, I'm a person, you're a person. I'm a person who likes these goldfish crackers. Well, you're a person like me, so that must mean you like them too. So, maybe I'm not stating this very well, but in a sense, it seems that they have the sense that we are individuals, and yet we are all part of the same species. Right. And that just the one refinement comes later when they say, well, okay, I'm a person, you're a person, I like these things, but, well, you could like these other things, and...
Well, in fact, what we discovered was that when we did the same experiment with 15-month-olds, only a couple of months earlier, those children really did seem to think that everybody would like the same thing. Right. So the 15-month-olds did give you the crackers, whether you liked the crackers or whether you liked the broccoli. But the 15-month-olds seemed to be able to differentiate other things about people. So I think the important thing is that it isn't as if there's a single moment when children have a sense of self or recognize that other people are going to be different. Mm-hmm. I think the right way of telling the story is that babies start out assuming a lot of similarity between themselves and other people, although I think even from the beginning they already recognize that they're in some sense a separate individual. They do seem to start out assuming that they're going to feel the same way as others, and then gradually over the course of the first couple of years differentiating, well, wait a minute, I'm different from you in this respect.
Let's take another call, and this is someone in Southern Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. How
yes.
you doing?
Good.
I wanted to know what you thought about this idea that I had heard. As you know, with a child when it's crying, that in a sense is an early warning that there's something wrong. You know, but and it knows that, and then a mother should also be able to know when the crying is really just crying, and there ain't really anything wrong. So, I mean, it should be a natural sense there anyway, I would think. And if we have problems with our children when they're older, you know, at the checkout line, they're crying for candy and they just won't take no. If we would start early enough, because the children, in a sense, are learning to manipulate you in that when they cry, they get what they want. Now, I know there's a thin line between neglect and taking care of the child, but we can start early and in a sense, you know, the responsibility of the way the children lash out, you know, adolescents and shootings and stuff, if we start as parents in an early stage, we might could alter that course. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, it's interesting. I think there's a very different story, and that's part of what we do as developmentalists, depending on how old the children are that you're talking about. So it's true to begin with, for instance, that caregivers can differentiate what the meaning of different kinds of cries sort of strikingly from very early on. Moms and dads can identify this is a hunger cry, this is a pain cry, and so forth. For young infants, all the evidence is that babies really need to be in close physical contact with adults for a lot of the time. That seems to be kind of what the way they're naturally set up. And again, you can kind of make sense if you think about evolution. Being close to a grown-up is very sensible if you're an immature baby. So I think all the evidence is for young babies that when they get picked up when they cry, that means that they cry less. What that really is a signal, even if it isn't a signal of pain or hunger, just the need for close physical contact is really a need for babies. And they do better if that need is satisfied. So I think all the evidence is quite clear that you can't spoil, say, a 6-month-old or a 3-month-old by picking them up when they cry. In fact, quite the opposite. That actually makes them cry less. On the other hand, when you're talking about that toddler in the supermarket, that's a very different kind of story. And we also know that when babies get to be about 18 months old, they start actually trying to figure out something about this point I mentioned before, what do I want and what do you want? And what happens when we want different things, when we have different agendas? And we think that they even do these kind of experiments to say, okay, well, what happens if I touch this lamp cord that you don't want me to touch? If you think of the babies as being little psychologists, we parents are sort of the lab rats. We're the ones who are getting tested. And in those circumstances, I think it's very important for parents to actually give the babies the information. Now, not babies, but children, the information that, no, this is not what we do around here. And it isn't just a matter of somehow disciplining the children. It's a matter of the children actually wanting information from the adults about what happens, what gives, who wants what, how does this world that I've been born into work? And adults really need to give the children that information. No, this isn't what we do here. This isn't the way that you're supposed to act or function. And that's as much a process of education, really, as it is a process of discipline. Mm. So I think it really depends on the age that you're talking about. For infants, that cry isn't an experiment. It isn't manipulative. It's an expression of a real need to be in close physical contact with adults. For toddlers, that's a very different situation.
Well, there, and I think you're encouraging parents to look differently at frustrating toddler behavior. I think for parents, sometimes we think this kid's just doing this to get me. they're pushing my buttons. They're doing it on purpose. So when they do something, you say, "No, don't do that." Then they do it again.
Right.
You say, "No, don't do that." Then they do it again. And you say, "I told you, don't do that." And then they do it again. And you think, "Oh, well, they're just jerking me around." But that's really not the purpose of what they're doing. They're
right.
not doing it to frustrate you.
Right. Right. And in fact, I think it's kind of interesting. You know, the babies, toddlers get just as frustrated as grown-ups in these kind of terrible, awful, terrible two situations. They don't like being in situations of conflict with the adults around them. But this experimental drive, this drive to try and work out what's going on? How's this work? Why are they saying no? What happens? You can watch kids in the terrible twos where, you know, you say, "No, don't drop the spoon on the ground." So they move the spoon right to the very, very, very edge of the high chair, you know, looking at you to see, okay, does this count? Is this, it's not really dropping it, is it? If it just sort of falls off the edge. And again, it's easy to be frustrated and feel like they're just driving you crazy. But in fact, if you think of them as little scientists, that's a kind of experiment. Okay, seriously, does this count? Does this count? And I think if parents can give consistent information, as difficult and frustrating as that is, you're really telling the baby something.
Mm. We're a little past the midpoint, or right at the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest, Allison Gopnik, is a psychologist. She's a faculty member at University of California, Berkeley. This is her area of research, and if you're interested in reading some more about the work that she's done, she and colleagues have done, you might look at the book that I mentioned, which is titled The Scientist in the Crib, published by Random House in 1999. And if you're also interested in hearing more on the subject, if you're here in and around, yes, it's actually HarperCollins. She's writing me out there. I'm sorry. HarperCollins. The book's out there. Go to the library. Go to the bookstore. Look for it. If you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you would like to hear more on the subject, she's going to be giving a talk in the MillerCom series tonight at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center. So yeah, anyone should feel welcome. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. To our next caller back here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to run two things by your guest. One is probably you know about it because you're from California, but I was watching a news magazine on Monday night, Dateline, NBC, and they had this story about Tracy Hogg.
I don't know this.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Well, then this should be a revelation to you because this lady, this little segment was one of the most interesting I've ever seen. She is a baby consultant. And she was originally working pretty much with celebrities. But the thing is, even on the phone, she can interpret what the baby is trying to get across. In its cry, and like they showed, for example, someone calling her up, and they put the baby up to the phone, and the lady said, "Well, okay, put it up to put the baby up to your chest and start saying shh, shh, shh like that." Immediately, after the kid had been crying for like a couple hours, immediately the kid stopped crying, and it gave three or four examples. Differing examples. Another case, it was too much air in its milk. It was just astounding. And the person interviewing her was kind of tearing her hair out. Apparently, she brought up a few kids without this kind of information. She wrote a book called "Secrets of the Baby Whisperer."
This is. I'm laughing because this is. It's interesting as a bit of a social commentary, really, because what I think the science shows is that capacity to interpret babies' behavior is something that really anybody who's a practiced caregiver who's had any experience with babies very quickly and spontaneously learns how to do. And it seems to be so typical of the United States that we should have someone who actually gets money to be a consultant to do this. This is what any grandmom or aunt or pretty much anybody who's had babies will be able to do, things like identify different cries and respond to them in different ways. It's probably also a sign of how incredibly anxious American parents are about their children, that they would, again, sort of get this expertise about it. So, again, anybody who's interacted with babies for any period of time learns to detect and understand the way that the baby's responding. And if you simply pay attention to what babies are doing and how babies are acting, then quite spontaneously, caregivers can manage to do this, to figure out what the babies are thinking and to respond appropriately and naturally. That's just part of the natural process of caregiving. So it isn't any special secret. It's just what it means to be a parent. And I think it's, but I do think it's very typical of the fact that people don't trust just that natural process of caregiving and are convinced that there's videotapes or books or special, you know, programs that you can somehow do that will actually make your baby smarter or make you be able to understand what your baby is like. And I the more I've found out about these things, the more indignant I am about the degree of fraud that's out there that's kind of trying to exploit the fact that parents are understandably anxious about what their babies are going to be like.
So, I think if it's a first baby, you know, they can be given a little compassion.
I mean, my sympathies are entirely with the parents. And I think what it really reflects is the fact that we don't have the kind of broad support network that we used to have young parents. So whereas a parent might in the past, what they would have done is call up an aunt or call a grandmother or someone else around or a sister and say, gee, I can't figure out what's wrong. What do you think is wrong? And have the sister say, well, pick up the baby and jiggle it. We put parents in this terribly isolated, difficult position, and they don't have that kind of background. And I guess it's better if they can get it anyway, then that's better than they're not getting that kind of background and support.
Yeah, she's starting a cottage industry around this, and it's interesting that she claims that it works with any baby of any culture. They all have the same vocabulary, so to speak. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, then I'll hang up, is you said that there was this mimicking ability.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be related at all to this notion of mirror neurons, if you're familiar with that?
That's a very interesting question, and we've wondered about that. It is true that there are these mirror neurons that seem to be designed in animals to these are neurons that fire both when the animal is performing an action itself and when it sees another animal perform the action. And people have speculated that that might be related to this imitation. But the interesting thing is, as far as we can tell, the infant imitation is really uniquely human. So even though other animals, monkeys, for instance, have these mirror neurons, they don't actually imitate. Sort of the opposite of what you think about monkey see and monkey do. Other animals don't have this capacity to imitate, and certainly the babies don't have the capacity to imitate that we see in humans. So it's a bit of a puzzle. We don't know exactly what the relationship is between these abilities that are so important in humans and then what seems to be a kind of more primitive capacity that we see in other animals. So it's a real open, interesting question.
And I appreciate the questions of the caller. We'll continue. Let's go to line number two, and that would be in a person in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a question, I hope it's not too obscure, but I seem to have the recollection of reading a study at one time that dealt with infants, and it seems macabre now, but they would suck on a little device that would give them milk, but only in a certain coded way, like every third time,
mm-hmm.
fourth time. And they developed real complicated codes, and the child seemed to, like, they measured his intent of how much effort he put in sucking.
Mm-hmm.
And when he knew he had to suck it to get it to go to the next click, say.
Mm-hmm.
But he would realize that he wouldn't have to suck it. He'd only get milk in the third click.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did this, as I recall the study, it was pretty elaborate, and the infant seemed to be able to develop, understand the codes, no matter, you know, either the level of complexity. I wonder if you heard anything about children's brains like that.
Yeah, I don't know the particular study you're talking about, but there are lots of studies which show that babies are extremely good, amazingly good, at picking up information about the contingencies between what they do and what happens out in the world. So you can do a study, for instance, where the baby will turn his head, and when he turns his head, a bunch of lights will go on. And the babies will very rapidly learn quite complicated kinds of sequences of behaviors that they have to do to get the lights to turn on. And what's even more interesting is, after a while, they don't even look at the lights really anymore. So it isn't anymore that they're doing it because they want to get the milk or because they want to see the lights. They seem to just love the problem itself. So it's more like they're just sort of saying, well, let me figure out how this system works where I turn my head to get the lights. More even than let me figure out what I have to do to get the lights. Babies really love that. There's beautiful experiments that have been done by a woman named Carolyn Rovey Collier. Just taking babies, tying a ribbon between the baby's foot and a mobile. And even very, very young babies, 3 or 4 month olds, will very rapidly learn how they have to kick to make the mobile work in a particular way. So babies are really amazingly good at figuring out very complicated sequences of actions that will lead to some kind of result.
Well, I really appreciate this call because I've wondered if I've had that right for the last 10 years. And so it's good to get reassurance. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. To Savoy, this is the next caller, line number 3. Hello.
Yes. I am greatly impressed by this research that Professor Gopnik talks about all of the things that babies know and can learn. But there's one puzzle I would like for her to comment on, and that's, I think it's called generally childhood amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that we humans seem not to be able to deliberately recall events earlier than maybe the second year or somewhere in the second or third year. And I wondered what this research bears on that question.
Mm-hmm. That's another fascinating question about development. And we think that we might be starting to understand a little bit about it. It turns out that even very young babies, even 9-month-olds, can remember events that took place a little while before, and we can actually demonstrate in the lab that they can even remember things that happened, say, a month before. So it isn't that babies can't remember things. They can. But it is true that as adults, we don't have memories typically until we're about 2 or 3. We think that this may be because when children get to be between 3 and 4, they start understanding the way that their own thoughts and emotions and experiences are connected to the thoughts and emotions and experiences they had before. So, for instance, we did an experiment where we showed a 3-year-old a closed-up candy box. And then we opened up the candy box, and it turned out that there were really pencils in the box. And then we asked the child, closed up the box, and said, what did you think was in this box when you first saw it? Well, 3-year-olds say, I always thought there were pencils in the box. So they don't seem to know that they thought one thing before, that they had one set of thought or knowledge or ideas before in the past, and they have a different one now. They don't seem to connect their past mind with their current mind. And if you talk to 3-year-olds, you know, you tell them some wonderful fact if you're a mother, and then they say, oh yeah, I always knew that, you know, 5 minutes later. And in fact, we can show scientifically that they will say, oh yeah, I always knew that. I knew that ever since I was a little baby. And it may be that part of what it means to have memory, what we sometimes call autobiographical memory, is not just the fact that things happened to us, but the fact that we changed and developed. The way we felt when we were 3 was related to the way we feel now when we're 4. And children don't really seem to have that idea of life as a kind of unfolding narrative, all these things that have happened to me in particular, until they're about 3 or 4 years old. And we think that that's probably why we don't have that first part of our life coded as being part of sort of our life story.
Well, thank you very much. But I would like to ask just one other question.
Sure.
In connection with this. Then, is this kind of the birth of consciousness? And then I'll hang up and let you
Just a little simple question like that, right?
Yeah, is that the birth of consciousness?
Well, again, it depends on, just like it depends on what you mean by a self, it depends on what you mean by consciousness. We think that babies, literally from the time they're born, have consciousness in the sense that we think they have conscious awareness of what's going on around them. So in that sense, we think babies are clearly conscious from the time they're born. But there's another sense of consciousness, which is, again, the sense of having a single individual sense of a single conscious self extended through space and over time, knowing that my consciousness, the me now, is the same as the me yesterday and the same as the me 6 months ago. And that's also connected with our sense of consciousness. So, you know, there are neurological patients who have amnesia who can't remember what happened to them. And in some sense, their consciousness of the world seems different. And a three-year-old who doesn't realize that they just a minute ago thought that there were candies in the box in some ways seems to have a different kind of consciousness than we do. So I don't think I would say that they're not conscious before then, but certainly their consciousness may be very different from ours before as they develop.
Does that somehow connect with these kinds of experiments that and probably if you have children, you also know the same thing, that there's a certain point at which kids think if something's out of sight, it doesn't exist.
Right.
You do that thing where you can show them a teddy bear, then you put a box over it, and at a certain point, they don't understand the fact that, well, it's still there, but it's under the box. They think, if I can't see it,
right,
it's not on the face of the earth anymore.
Well, that's a complicated story. We've begun to realize that babies, in fact, do know much more about objects that are out of sight than we used to think. And in fact, work that René Baillargeon has done right here at the University of Illinois suggests that even very young babies already can represent an object, even if they can't see it. What it may very well be true, though, is that babies don't understand the whole process of vision about how you see things and how you don't until much later. And I think, at any rate, that that's part of why they don't look under the box for the object. It's not so much that they can't imagine that an object could be there. They just don't know how this whole process works of when you see something and when you don't see something and how you can see things and how we've done work that shows that 2-year-olds have some trouble understanding, I could see one thing and you could see another thing. So again, I think the important point is that our adult sense of consciousness has a whole lot of stuff built into it. And that whole system only develops quite gradually over the period of infancy.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Allison Gupnik from UC Berkeley. We're talking about some of the research that she's been involved in, looking at what babies know and how they learn. And she has co-authored a book that would go into a lot of this in greater depth if you're interested. The Scientist in the Crib is the book. And she'll also be talking about this tonight on the U of I campus. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can go and hear her. And you can call in here, too, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next person up is in Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Hello. You actually answered part of my question regarding object permanence.
Mm-hmm.
I had kind of a two-part memory question. I have a six-month-old.
Mm-hmm.
All of our relatives live very far away, so she sees them infrequently.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we wanted to do so that she could remember who they are when she does see them is kind of make a picture board.
Mm-hmm.
And say, that's grandpa, that's grandma, that's your aunt. Does that sort of thing work with babies?
Well, it probably wouldn't work with a six-month-old. By the time children have a hard time kind of getting the link between pictures and real things that those are supposed to be pictures of, until they're about, you know, a year, 18 months. So children might learn to recognize some of the features and attach them to the word grandpa. But the idea, this is a picture of a separate person, another person who is grandpa. That seems to be an idea that children start to get, again, about, you know, between a year and 2 years. And that's partly why they start liking picture books and so forth at about that age.
Okay.
And the six-month-old will mainly eat the picture book.
Yep, that's doing a fine job of going through them.
But a 14- or 15-month-old will actually start to get, oh, okay, that picture, banana, that's like that thing that I was eating that's banana. So I think that that's actually a great thing to do with slightly older children. It probably wouldn't make too much of a difference to a six-month-old.
Okay. The other question I had is, just after she turns 9 months, I'll be away for 2 weeks for military training.
Mm-hmm.
And don't exactly think she'll forget me, per se, but I wonder what she'll think of me when I come back and what she'll remember about me.
Well, we know that babies, as I said, babies can remember much more for much longer than we thought, and especially they can remember people. They remember a lot of things about what a person is like and how they interact with them.
Uh-huh.
We think, in fact, part of the reason why babies get scared of strangers when they're about 10 months, a year old, and start, you know, not liking to be separated from their parents, is because they're starting to be able to remember and recognize this is a person who I really know and differentiate that from someone else. And they can certainly keep that, that kind of idea easily over the space of over the space of 2 weeks.
Okay.
So I think babies certainly will recognize someone over that space at about 9 months.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. And thank you. And again, to someone else, this is Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting program. I thank you for it. I'm glad to hear lots of women calling in. These talk shows usually dominated by male callers such as myself. I wonder what the implication for Piaget is. You sort of touched upon it as far as object permanence. That's a first question. And then secondly, mental representation is an issue that I have a quarrel with, I guess. We talk about mental languages when I don't think mental processes are linguistic in that sense. And part of what we may see or what we don't understand or don't remember of our early life may be that our mental processes were not included as in a linguistic mm-hmm. sense, and that that we don't have words to attach to memories that that we probably do have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those people who talk about birth trauma and things of that sort certainly indicate that we do have. Or suggest that we have great memories of the past. So those are the two issues I'd like you to speak to. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Okay. First about Piaget. Piaget, of course, was really the founder of our discipline. He's the great man of developmental psychology and was indeed, he and his wife, by the way, who did a lot of the observational work with him, did amazing work. But of course, you know, that's his stuff was done back in the 1930s. It wouldn't be a very good theory if it hadn't changed over the course of 70 years. And almost all of the empirical, a lot of the claims that Piaget made, especially ones about babies and children not being able to do things, have turned out not to be true. So, in fact, children can do much, much more from a much earlier age than Piaget thought. And I think that's pretty generally accepted now. He's still, you know, a great kind of theoretical broad figure, and many of the things he pointed to are still very important for the field. But the idea that children couldn't represent objects out of sight, that they couldn't understand causality and so forth, those things have turned out not to be true, just empirically. Now, in terms of your second question about mental representation, it is true, and in fact, I've done some work suggesting that learning language really makes a big difference to the way that we understand and conceive of the world. And it's certainly possible that part of our childhood amnesia stems from the fact that we can't represent our early understanding of the world linguistically. On the other hand, I think the evidence is pretty clear that there aren't really articulable memories from, say, before about two. And part of the problem is it's very easy for people to feel as if they remember something, even when they don't. So I think there isn't any very good evidence that those memories that people claim to have of birth and so forth are actually real memories. They're probably things that people have constructed later on. On the other hand, babies clearly do have experiences and have representations of those experiences from well before they start to talk.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And to, let's see, another caller here. This would be Ann Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what is the implications for parents and parenting? Fairly simple one, but I don't think it's been touched on yet.
Oh, it's a good question. In fact, I would have asked it myself if you hadn't asked it. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think there's two sets of implications, and in some ways they're kind of go in opposite directions. So one thing that's become very clear is that parents play an enormously important role in this process. Parents are actually giving babies just the information that babies need to learn, need to use to learn. You can think about caregivers and babies as being this beautifully designed system for learning, really. But what we've discovered is that the way that parents do that is through their natural spontaneous interactions, through the goos and the gahs and the funny high-pitched voice we use when we talk to babies. All of those things turn out to actually be giving babies really important information about the world. So just that natural spontaneous process of interaction, interacting, paying attention, playing, gooing, giggling, that's really where the teaching is taking place. And the implication of that is that parents should not be going out and, you know, spending a lot of money on videos and flashcards. The best you can say about those programs is that they're completely useless. The worst you can say is if you're spending your time doing that, then you're not going goo goo gaga, which is actually the good stuff. On the other hand, as I said before, we provide absolutely no support for caregivers and parents in the course of this, the most profound educational experience that ever goes on in the course of life. We spend billions of dollars educating 18-year-olds, and much as I love 18-year-olds, I can tell you they don't learn a millionth as much as 6-month-olds learn. And yet we do nothing to support the process of learning and teaching that's going on early on. And in fact, we make it very hard for that process to take place. 20% of American children are growing up in poverty. Caregivers are paid less than dog catchers. Parents, of course, don't get paid anything at all. So I think on the one hand, we don't need to have a lot of extra special educational stuff. On the other hand, we need to support the natural process of caregiving and education much more than we do now.
Thank you.
All right. We'll get one more here again in southern Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering to know something about the visual to the hearing percentage. We are primarily visually oriented creatures. Mm-hmm. Where a dog is primarily oriented towards his smell. He conceives the world first through his smell, then through his eyesight. That's why I was wanting to know what percentage of learning does an infant go through as far as visual as opposed to, say, his sense of smell or his sense of hearing? Mm-hmm. And does that percentage change as he grows older? Thank you.
That's really a fascinating question. One of the things that we've learned is that children already are putting together information from different senses from the time they're born. So if you think about those imitation experiments I mentioned, babies already are linking the way they feel, the way their tongue feels, and something they see visually. We know that they link the sounds they hear to the way that things feel. And I think it's important that babies are learning a lot from touch and from feel and from smell and from taste. And I think it's just we psychologists who don't know as much about those senses as we do about vision and hearing. So our research has mostly been focused on vision and also on hearing. We know that babies are learning a tremendous amount, for instance, about language early on and have beautifully tuned systems for decoding the sounds of language from very early on, much more powerful than any computer, for instance, could have. So I think babies are learning from all their senses and they're integrating information from all their senses early on. And they're probably much more multimodal creatures than we grown-ups or psychologists are.
We will have to leave it there because we're here at the end of the time. But again, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I'll say one more time that if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Allison Gopnik, she'll be talking about this research as part of the Millercom series tonight, 7:30 in the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And of course, if you can't attend, you might look for the book that she co-authored that also explains a lot of this research. The Scientist in the Crib is the title. It's published by HarperCollins. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our guest, Allison Gopnik, she's professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley.